This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. Our guest today is Dr. Scott Mosman, Assistant Professor in the Department of Military History. Dr. Mosman, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
And so, among many things, Dr. Mosman is a Navy vet and expert on military intelligence. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Let's start with the very, very simple definition. People might be familiar with intelligence in the realm of an organization like the CIA. So, first of all, very generally, what is intelligence?
I could give you the basic, which is it's collecting information on adversaries, neutral countries, even our friends. Mm-hmm. But it's getting that information and making analysis of that information, which is more important. Analysis is what makes intelligence. Otherwise, it's just information.
Okay. So what's the difference between intelligence, that very general definition, and military intelligence? What makes it military?
Well, two things. One, depends on who is actually conducting the intelligence. And so you have military intelligence is like the Army, Navy, Coast Guard, Marines, whoever that organization is, which is a military body. Mm-hmm. It also can mean intelligence collecting on purely military targets.
Okay, so the CIA might collect intelligence on an organization like a drug cartel, whereas a military intelligence organization is more focused on, like, as you say, friendly, neutral, enemy, military. Am I understanding that right?
Right.
So if we're taking a look at intelligence, some people might look at the term reconnaissance and conflate or confuse the two. How did the terms reconnaissance and military intelligence fit together?
Well, reconnaissance is more like collecting that information. So you have a collection cycle in intelligence, and collections is one of the five steps. And so reconnaissance is just purely getting that information from somewhere. And it's information. It may be raw. When you're talking about intelligence, it's processing that information to making it something valuable and useful for a commander or a decision maker or whatever.
So you say that it's the first of the five steps. Could you walk us through the steps?
Well, there's five steps. It's you first collect the intelligence, and then you make the analysis. You do the make a product, make sure that the receiver, the person who wants it, gets it, and then you get feedback. So it's a five-step thing, and it's just a loop. So the feedback tells you, oh, maybe we didn't get everything we needed. We need to tell the collectors to collect this information.
Mm-hmm. And people listening may be familiar with the terminology. It's usually a series of abbreviations or acronyms, like HUMINT.
Mm-hmm.
So what are kind of the different kinds of intelligence?
There is a variety. There's HUMINT, which is human intelligence, signals intelligence. Comment, there's IMINT, which is imagery intelligence. Mm-hmm. The MASINT, which is kind of a weird bag of different things. There's PEATSINT, which is pizza collecting. how many pizzas is the enemy collecting, therefore they're planning a
right.
Or march or whatever. So there's a variety of different ways, and we have collectors in the intelligence community doing all different types of things.
And we laugh, but that's actually been a thing. Mm-hmm. Is where people see the late night deliveries to headquarters to see what's going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, or how many cars are in a parking lot or something like that. Yeah.
Right.
All right, so we tend to think of war, particularly in the popular image, as being kind of like Band of Brothers, where you have a small group of people, because that's how many people you can follow on a screen, and those groups of people are doing things, they may have inputs, they may be given a sheet of paper or a piece of information, and then they act on it. So let's kind of walk through the levels of war and talk about how intel works at each level. Let's start at that low level.
Yeah, the low level is tactical intelligence, sometimes called combat intelligence. I prefer tactical intelligence because combat, I don't know, you don't necessarily at tactical level have to be always at combat. But tactical is helping that individual platoon or that individual ship or that individual, if we're talking military intelligence, it's the very basic low level for a low level commander, like a company grade or whatever, to act on intelligence.
What's right on the other side of that hill?
Right, exactly.
And yeah. So I'll ask Army veteran Dr. Bill Nance, you did this as a company commander in combat. So what, how does this work for you?
So my combat experience is a little bit weird because we were doing counterinsurgency operations. But what it works on the at the tactical level is the brigade, or in my case, the corps, would send out a note and say, we need to know this. And so what we would do is we would send out, like when I was a cavalry squadron, S3 and XO, what we would do is we would have our three cavalry troops out front. A troop is a company-sized organization, about 13 Bradley fighting vehicles. And we'd send out, we'd tell one of the troops to go get that piece of that information. And they're going to send out their Bradleys as far as they can, and then hopefully without being seen. And then if we are trying to remain stealthy, they've got some scouts in the back that they will then dismount those scouts, and then they will crawl forward to try and see what's there. That's if we're doing stealthy and deliberate. Mm-hmm. Other ways we can do it is we can be, the term is forceful and rapid, or noisy and explosive is another way of putting it, which is we're going to drive forward into the enemy, and we will find the enemy's main defensive, we will find the enemy's scouts and try and kill them. There's a security, we won't talk about that. But then the idea being is that by the very fact of us making contact with the enemy and fighting the enemy and what he is fighting us with gives our intel guys in the back a picture of what is happening as we are actively exchanging blows with the enemy's security zone and hopefully their main body, which then gives them a better picture. They can unmask artillery, they might turn on some radars, they might start talking on the radio. Basically, the enemy is responding and starting to emit, which then lets the intel guys see everything.
So that's the land warfare aspect of this, probably the one with which listeners are most familiar. How does this work in the Navy, Dr. Mosman? Because obviously you don't have a lot of those things.
Yeah, at the Navy, at the tactical level, you're on a ship, or you're a SEAL, or you're whatever. So like, for instance, on a ship, you're trying to collect intelligence of what the picture is around you. Mm-hmm. And so it may be as simple as having a Snoopy team, believe it or not, it's called a Snoopy team, sitting on the top of a carrier or a ship, looking out on the horizon and seeing what that merchant ship is, or what that naval ship is, or what's flying in the air, and taking pictures of it so that we could identify it for other ships in the strike group. Mm-hmm. So it's the basic simple stuff.
Okay, so that's the tactical level. Let's jump up a level. How does intel work at the operational level?
The operational level, at the military level, I mean, it's a little different. Well, actually, it's a lot different between the Army and the Navy, because the Army is looking at the operational level, looking at the whole campaign or what the huge battlefield looks like. And mm-hmm. So at the operational level, you're trying to see what movements are happening all around you, as your Battle of the Bulge will be a good example of that. Mm-hmm. You know, what's going on that part of the battlefield 20 miles away.
Yeah, where are the enemy armies as opposed to enemy companies?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then the Navy is, where's the locations of the ships here off the coast of China or Japan or wherever, mm-hmm. and trying to find out where the locations are. Mm-hmm. And you collect the intel based on all different types of the ends we talked about.
Okay, and finally the top level, we will skip the theater strategic level because that's kind of in the weeds for Army folks. How does strategic intelligence work?
Strategic is nations, and it's broad subjects like what is the intentions of that nation over there doing? What is, how is their financial situation? What's the economic situation? What's the political situation over there? It's it can be done at the military level, but it's often when you think strategic, you're thinking all the way above, up to the Department of Defense, in our case with the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the president. And so we're trying to figure out intentions of hostile, neutral, or friendly countries.
So this might be the kind of stuff that will work its way into that folder that the president gets every morning.
Right.
So at that level, we've been talking about military intelligence, and we're kind of focusing it at that mm-hmm. level. But you said that at the national level, that starts to kind of, the lines start to blur.
Right.
So as broadly as possible, how do we connect the military intelligence up at the strategic level with the other strategic intelligence assets?
It's basically called, well, not necessarily assets, but I would say organizations.
Okay.
Because you got what's called an intelligence community. And right now, I think the number is up to 17 different organizations that all feed into the Director of National Intelligence. And then that's supposed to sort out into a consensus of what all the intelligence community is saying for the president. And so it used to be a little bit different prior to 9/11 because CIA doubled as the human expert.
Right.
At the same time, the ear for the president. But 9/11 showed that maybe there's some things that the mm-hmm. intelligence community needed to work on. So, mm-hmm.
All right, so we've gotten a very good overview of what intel is and how it works. Let's talk a little bit about the kind of people who do this. Obviously, if we're talking military intelligence, we're talking people in uniform. Is it normal for a person to work across the spectrum, across all levels of war, or do you specialize in one? Do you start in tactical and move up?
It's a depends thing. In military intelligence, you could work at all different types of spectrums. You could work at the low level tactical on the field. And you could go all the way up to, working for the White House Situation Room as a military guy. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I was in the Navy, I did all those different types of things, depending mm-hmm. on the situation. Now, in the civilian realm, they tend to be more specialized, especially like at CIA, if you're a human collector, and then you would also be doing analysis generally at the same level. It all depends on where you're at. It's a wide spectrum.
Okay, that certainly makes sense. Let's talk about what it is that you've done a lot of research on, which is kind of the history of strategic intelligence in the U.S. The way I see it, there's kind of three eras for intelligence. There's the pre-1947 era. And that's because there's not really any intelligence organizations. It's kind of a, hodgepodge. Then 1947, 1948, you get the National Security Act. It builds the National Security State, all the intel organizations we're familiar with. And then 2003 is when you get the Homeland Security State. That's when you get the DNI, and that all changes. So first of all, do you think that's a fair breakdown?
Definitely. I'll admit it, I'm more comfortable pre-1947 only because, I enjoy the era. But two, then I don't have to worry about classification issues and stuff like that. So, I focused generally from about 1882 to 1947. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I do that is because before 1882, there is an intelligence in the United States. We could document that with Washington's spies. You could document that with tactical level Pinkertons. Information. You could talk about how we do reconnaissance and engineering and stuff like that.
That character Harrison in the movie Gettysburg.
Right, exactly. Exactly. But it's not as fun because it's not as developed. Intelligence really starts getting going in 1882 when you talk about the managerial revolution, and that's a phrase coined by Walter Millis.
So let's start there. Let's start in the post-war period where you have the Army's task is largely to work on reconstruction, also the West. The Navy is out doing things we've talked about in prior episodes with Dr. Kuhn, where you kind of have these sailor diplomats who are spreading American hard and soft power. And as you point out, this is the Gilded Age, moving into the Progressive Era. We've got these ideas that will eventually become Taylorism, of building these specialized managers who then run these very complex organizations.
Yeah.
So how does that play out within military intelligence?
Well, it's you first have to divide it when you're talking about military intelligence with Army and Naval. And after the Civil War, you did have these Army and Navy diplomats. And so they would go over, and we had very weak Army and Navy in general. So we'd go over there and we'd go and beg for information, and we go see what other places are doing. For instance, with the Army, you know, you have people like Emory Upton talking about how we need to get better at not only intelligence, but just war in general. And then you have the Navy. We send the diplomats, as Dr. Kuhn talked about, and we observe countries like Chile and the war in the Pacific, and we notice that we're not that good as a Navy. We suck, really. We're terrible. And so we realize that in this managerial revolution, we need to get better at collecting information and then disseminating it throughout the Department of War and Department of the Navy.
So let's start with the, and this might be two different groups, so feel free to parse it as you need to.
Sure.
Is first off, what kind of folks are we talking about when we start talking about sending out these officers? Are they educated? Are they just the next officer on the street? And then as they start to decide that we need to create this organization, are those the people we're getting, or are we getting a different breed of person?
We're getting a go-getter, a person who is, well, as termed by Karsten, the aristocracy of the Navy, or the aristocracy of the Army. These are guys who want the Army, the Navy, to get better. For instance, there's a guy named Theodorus Mason, who is a lieutenant in 1882, but he's been in the Navy for about 17 years.
Okay, and for Army listeners, a lieutenant is a O3, captain in the Army.
Yeah, so we're sending out people like that who are looking at our Navy and going, the rest of the world is a lot better. We have resting hulks of ships sitting in our harbors. We have, we're stuck here with the Army as a constabulary force, and the frontier is ending. We gotta look elsewhere. Our missions are elsewhere, and that kind of rides on the coats of the Gilded Age, where we're realizing that trade and economy is more important as the 1880s and 1890s roll around.
So, are they being sent out? Are they just they're out on their own particular? Or like, are they being sent out by the United States government to conduct these fact-finding missions, or are they doing this in the course of normal overseas duty?
Both. Both. Okay. So if it's Army or Navy, they're being sent over to observe different operations. And then they're just doing out of curiosity. Theodorus Mason is a good example of that. Don't mistake it yet for naval attachés and Army attachés, because that develops in the early to mid-1880s, when we discover, well, the rest of the world is actually doing that in Europe. That seems pretty fashionable. Why don't we do that too?
So, is this an accurate description? It's a Navy officer who is on part of the Far East Asia Squadron, and just on his own hook grabs a camera and decides to go wandering around a harbor.
Yes, and it's not even like spying. It's just, hey, at that point,
he's sightseeing.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, even then, spying wasn't that big of an issue. It wasn't in terms of the military. Now, you had spies, you know, like in the civilian world, but in the military, everybody was looking at everybody else's harbors like, okay.
And it was also normal up to that point,
right,
really through into the 20th century, to invite observers, right? There are great reports of American observers in other people's wars. Phil Sheridan, the Civil War general, was the observer for the Franco-Prussian War, for example.
Yeah. George McClellan observed the Crimean War prior to the Civil War.
And it helped him out so much.
Yeah.
So you mentioned this kind of chalk line date and this individual who starts us down the path of the strategic intel organization. So talk us through that.
Well, and let's be careful when we use strategic, because they don't know what they are yet. So this is 1882, and There's a guy named John Walker, who's the Bureau of Navigation's head, and he's observed through just his observations in the Navy, and then he was a prior railroad man who knows efficiency and knows managerial skills. He knows the value of organizations. And then he knows this guy named Theodore Mason that we've talked about, who really wants to start up an organization that collects intelligence. First, information, and then maybe intelligence later. And so there's a chalk line date, 1882, where these two gentlemen, with the help of the Secretary of the Navy, Hunt and then Chandler, because it's right in the same years, they basically go, we need to create an organization that we get all this information coming into the state war and Navy building. Mm-hmm. We need to figure out what to do with this. It's starting to pile up. And so they develop a system They do the Office of Naval Intelligence, which started in 1882 in March. And they don't really know exactly what they're going to do, but they're going to do it. And they're going to try to figure out what their mission is. And so they start collecting this information, and they build these card catalog systems, similar to what the State Department had for their diplomatic type things. And so then they build this card catalog system, and then they go, okay, maybe we could actually write some products of what this means, like what the Battle of whatever happened in Egypt in the 1880s or whatever happened with the British. And so they create these products. And it's very basic. I wouldn't even call it an analysis. It's just an account of what happened.
Like a Wikipedia almost?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So how current are these reports? Because, again, this is the 1880s. So we have some, I mean, I think we have some of the first undersea telegraph lines.
Yeah, we do have telegraph. We have light speed communication, but. Yeah.
This is not like the daily morning brief, right?
No, it's not like actionable intelligence. It's more like, hey, this is a brochure of what's happening in this country. You know,
right? Yeah, there was a fight with the British and some of their colonists in Sudan a month ago.
Yeah, or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's funny, is the word intelligence didn't mean intelligence until the early 20th century. Intelligence meant just news.
Yeah.
At the time, and it kind of differentiated when you got to the early part of the 20th century.
So. Yeah, the word basically originally in English means understanding.
Right.
Okay, so you mentioned that, so we have this chalk line date, 1882, we have an organization in the Navy, and you mentioned that you take it through 1947. So in that period, we're covering three major wars, the Spanish-American War, the World Wars, and any number of small engagements. The Philippine War, interventions in Haiti, things like that. So, broad overview before we dive into each conflict. Mm-hmm. How does strategic intelligence evolve over that period, just very generally?
Well, it evolves with society. So, I've done a lot of research about how it's a micro history in a sense. How does these organizations, like the Army has an organization called the Military Information Division that morphs into the Military Intelligence Division. But how do they relate to the different epochs of American society? So how do they relate to the managerial revolution? How do they relate to Jeffersonian, Hamiltonian impulses? Or how do they relate to the Spanish-American War? And then you look at the military preparedness movement. You look at, as you mentioned, the Progressive Era. Mm-hmm. You look at all these eras. And so they evolve their missions to reflect what's going on at the time. And to be honest, they're looking for missions. They're small organizations at the time. When it started, ONI was four people. Military Information Division in 1885 is two people. And so they're looking for any mission, whether it's strategic, operational, tactical. They really want to be at the strategic because that's where the President and the Department of War and Department of Navy are at.
Right.
So they evolve over time with these organizations.
That's a really good point. We tend to sometimes view militaries in isolation, but they are always a product of their societies.
Yeah.
Very briefly, you mentioned they were like such a small organization.
Mm-hmm.
So where are they getting the reports from? Are they reading the newspapers? Or, I mean, is this a clipping service? Or what are we doing here?
No, the intelligence, for the first few decades especially, the intelligence comes from the attachés over in mainly Europe. So the first naval attaché was a guy named by Frenchy Chadwick, who was a go-getter, again, one of these navalists, aristocracy guys, went in 1883 to England. And there's a rich tradition of naval attachés in England. Mm-hmm. And he was the first naval attaché. The army attaché, I think, was in 1889. So you have these are your sources of information. You didn't really have SIGINT in the first few decades. You didn't really have IMINT. You didn't really have any of these, but you had HUMINT and open source. So open source is another thing, which is they get it from newspapers. But again, the naval attachés or army attachés would find the newspaper clippings they have from London and send that back. Or they talk to some of their counterparts in England or wherever they're at and get information. So it's really open source and naval attachés. And
you said something there at the end that I think is worth drawing out a little bit. So you mentioned that there are connections with kind of sister organizations within other countries.
Right,
did I hear that right?
Yeah. Well, in the first couple of decades when the U.S. was doing this collection in Europe, nobody really paid attention to them. I mean, we had a lot of money coming, and we gave them a lot of money. And for the first two decades, nobody paid attention to the Americans. Like, okay, yeah, here you want this information. Sure, you could have it. Well, it started to tighten up in the late 19th century, like the last 5 years, as the great powers competition got a little bit stronger. And so the information started to tighten up a little bit, and it started to get a little bit cutthroat.
Mm-hmm. So on that note, a lot of what you're talking about doesn't seem particularly clandestine. It almost seems like a very collegial, hey, this is what we're doing.
Right. Let's wander into the port and count the ships.
And so as the information starts to tighten up, does that mean the information is drying up, or are they resorting to more clandestine approaches?
Probably a little bit more clandestine. For instance, when you talk about the Spanish and American War, the Americans were desperate for operational intelligence. So the naval attaché specifically, even guys like Bliss, Tasker Bliss, who was the army attaché in Europe, one of them there, they've started to form clandestine networks because they were desperate for where are the locations of these Spanish ships or whatever.
So let's talk about this, because this is in some ways the first global war America wages, Spanish-American War,
right.
And one in which intelligence, of course, is very important. So what happens here, very briefly, is the Spanish are kind of this decaying colonial power. They have some stuff the U.S. wants. Mm-hmm. The U.S. goes to war to take it. The precipitating thing is a rebellion in Cuba that the U.S. is intervening in.
Yeah.
The U.S. will end up with an independent Cuba, basically, that's an American protectorate. And the U.S. will gain Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the once over the war. This is a war waged across the world. There are major battles in Puerto Rico. There are major battles in the Philippines. So how does the strategic intelligence, how do these people play into this conflict in you know, kind of their first test?
13 years in.
Right. And we got to clarify, it's strategic military intelligence. But even then, that's the only intelligence coming around. I mean,
right.
Secret Service has something. Let's just put it this way. The U.S. Military, strategic military intelligence organizations failed miserably at strategic military intelligence. And I say that because we have the Military Information Division, which is in Washington, and then you have the Naval Intelligence, ONI, in Washington. Well, when you're talking about military guys and war, where do you think the military guys want to go first?
They want to go fight.
They want to go fight.
Yeah.
And intelligence isn't that fun.
Right.
They want to go sail their ships or fight with their muskets or whatever.
Were the two talking to each other?
You're talking about ONI and MID?
Correct.
Yes, especially at the attaché level. They're in the same building on the bottom floor for most of their time. So they're talking to each other. But when the war comes around, they don't want to be there. All of them put in their resignations and say, I want to go sail on the ship or go fight for this unit. Mm-hmm. Even Teddy Roosevelt leaves as the assistant secretary of the Navy and says, I want to go fight.
Yeah.
So on that, obviously when the war kicks off, everyone wants to run off.
Yeah.
How good were they at painting the picture of the Spanish armed forces before the war?
With the Navy, okay. We'll say with we had a guy named William S. Sims, who was in Spain and also Paris, who was really good at naval attaché. So we had a pretty good understanding with the capabilities of the Spanish Navy were. For the Army, we actually did pretty well preparing for the 3 years before. There was a guy who taught here at CGSC, Arthur Wagner, who was a head of MID, and they prepared well. The biggest thing that they were able to prepare were maps. Mm. Now, today, maps, you could go to Google and you could go to Rand McNally or whatever. Mm-hmm. Back then, maps were classified because of the information they had. Not only were units were or whatever, but just the what the island looked like if you were talking about Cuba or something like that.
Yeah, or where the anchorages were.
Right.
Or
so I would say on average at the strategic level before the war, MID and ONI, the two major organizations, were pretty good.
One of the things that's been picking at my brain there is that because in this day and age before radar, all that kind of stuff. You don't know where a ship is once it leaves harbor.
Yeah.
So there's the famous Battle of Manila Bay, which is really Admiral Dewey shooting up a bunch of Spanish ships at anchor
before they realize they're at war.
So the question is how did he, was this one of those that did he get lucky? Was this an intelligence coup or was this?
Dewey complained a lot about naval intelligence specific because he knew in Philippines there would be some trouble, but. When he asked for intelligence on the Philippine, on the Spanish Navy in the Philippines, the only information we had was from 10 years ago, and about a like some type of refrigerator ship or something like that. So Dewey was going, "Where's my intel, operational or strategic? I don't care." Yeah. And no one I said, "Sorry, we can't help you."
So he got. So you sailed into Middle Bay and got lucky.
Yeah, exactly.
Which first family of the Navy, the Deweys, tend to do in American history.
Yeah.
All right. So the Spanish-American War is, for all intents and purposes, kind of a walkover for the U.S. There's some issues on the ground. There's a famous former Confederate ordering attacks on Union positions, but the U.S. wins the war. Spain continues to decay. The U.S. gets all this stuff. So what would you say the takeaway is for the burgeoning military intel community from this conflict?
They came out pretty well, not because of their performance in the war, but how they prepared for the war. There was some congressional oversight of the Army and the Navy about poor performance in certain areas, but nobody complained about the Navy and Army, mainly because of what they did before the war. And there was actually a report about that the Navy put out. I can't give you the name of it, but it was basically saying what the accounts of the Spanish side were of the war from two famous admirals. And they published it, and it was so popular that they went over their exceeded amount of money and asked Congress for more money to publish it.
Huh.
And so, you know, they came out riding high. In fact, this is right on the start of the general staff system.
Right.
And so, especially for the Army, the military intelligence or Army intelligence was really looking good, and they expected a pretty good seat at the table when we're talking about the general staff.
So let's put a pin in the general staff point. We'll certainly come back to that. One final wrap-up question. You said that the military intel community came out looking good in large part because of what they did before the war.
Yeah.
Is that a function of military intelligence in general, or is that a function of the fact that this war was relatively short? It basically lasted a couple months.
Both, yeah. It only lasted 3 or 4 months. And to be honest, all the officers who left both organizations came back 4 months later, and they only had, in the Navy, they only had a retired 06 captain leading ONI and maybe one or two clerks or whatever, and then the Army had two officers. So. They didn't. It was the manning was just bare enough to do what they needed to do, but it was mainly beforehand that they did well.
So with that said, is that they really didn't have a lot of manning before the war. Mm. They got a good and they got a good reputation. However, they got there.
Yeah.
So did that translate into a larger, more capable organization between the Spanish-American War and World War One?
Yes. So, well. You have, you start off with 2 to 4, and 2 to 4 people or officers, and then you get to about a size of maybe 15 officers, right around 1900. World War One is hundreds of people in the organizations, but how you get there is very weird.
So let's talk about that intervening period, because we have talked about this on prior episodes. This is one of the most important periods in American military history. It's often understudied. Mm. But this is the period really where the American military goes from being a kind of amateurish organization that tends to cohere in wartime and then disappear afterwards, to a more professional one.
Some of the first field manuals are published.
Field manuals published. You have the root reforms. You basically have the acknowledgement that if the United States is going to be a world power, and it is, world's largest economy, it needs a military to match. And that waxes and wanes, but it never quite goes away the same way it had in the prior century. So how do we get from A to B? How do we get from these, you know, eight people in the basement of some building to, as you say, the hundreds of people by 1917?
In a weird, wacky way. And I'm going to concentrate on the military, the Army intelligence, because in 1903, they were looking pretty good. They got a seat at the table. They were one of the organizations in this general staff that had was one of the divisions, right? Well, the problem is the War Plans Division or War Plans College said, oh, we like the information you have. We're going to swallow you up as a division. And so they went from having a seat at the table to not barely existing in about 1910. Hmm. So there's a span between 1907, where Franklin Bell basically disbanded military intelligence from the Army, to about 1917, where all the intelligence functions were done by the War College.
So on that quick question there, are these professional, what we would know today as military intelligence officers, or are they these officers who are infantry officers, cavalry officers, artillery officers who are being seconded into this duty?
It's the latter. Most of them were infantry, armor, whatever you want to call it. Intelligence really didn't become a profession until after World War II. In terms of actual branches and designators. So you had this one guy named Ralph Van Diemen, who was a lieutenant in the Spanish-American War, who was at MID. He's known as the father of military intelligence, and he's one of the examples of the few people in this period that wanted to do military intelligence, because military intelligence wasn't sexy.
Right.
It wasn't fun. And so he was desperate to get the Army to realize they need military intelligence all the way up to the eve of World War I.
So it sounds like we've kind of seen a reversal, where before the turn of the century, you kind of had a few very ambitious people who wanted to be in military intelligence. And now it sounds like you're saying this is kind of the job that you get forced into.
Yeah, it's the desk job in D.C. I call it, in a lot of my scholarship, in the nadir of strategic military intelligence, because people at the higher levels, at the general levels, are going, why do we need this intelligence? Nobody can convince them that we need this intelligence. Isn't spying an anti-American thing to do? Mm-hmm. The public wouldn't want this, right?
So these guys are literally, if I can imagine it, it's the officer comes in and he sits down at a desk and it's a stack of papers of reports from all over the world.
Yeah.
And he has to read through them and then make sense of them and write a report.
Yeah, exactly. And what's happening in the teens before World War I, especially in the military army intelligence, is all these reports are coming from around the world back to the Army War College, and basically they're going nowhere. They're sitting on a desk. Even the punitive expedition information's sitting back in D.C., just sitting on a desk.
So Pershing, although people are reporting this, Pershing's not getting the take.
Yeah, right, exactly. So he's doing his own intelligence, kind of like what they did prior to 1882 on the prairie, where the reconnaissance and all that. He's making his own decisions, because in Washington, there, especially in intelligence, nobody's on the other end.
So there's almost a divide then, which is you have the tactical reconnaissance, which is, we'll use Pershing as an example. He has a couple regiments of cavalry with him.
And some auxiliaries.
That are going out there, and they're conducting what we, to start at the beginning, they're conducting reconnaissance.
Yeah.
and he might have some agents or some auxiliaries out there giving him intelligence. Yeah. But he's not actually getting any sort of real feed from DC as we would understand it today.
No, not at all, because the Army intelligence or Army establishment gave up on intelligence for that 15-year period. The Navy is a little bit better because the Navy has ONI, and they're being used to help do war plans. Mm-hmm. So, like, the early stages of War Plan Orange is being done with the help of ONI information from all the different attachés. They're not respected as much for their abilities, again, but they're better off than what the Army was during this time period. So
this is kind of running us into America's entry into World War I, yeah, which America watched happen in 1914, wanted nothing to do with. Wilson infamously ran in 1916 on the slogan, "He kept us out of war," yeah, then immediately turns around and gets the U.S. into the war. So I imagine that was maybe a bit of a surprise to a lot of people. So how does World War I affect this? How does military intelligence change during that war?
Well, at the strategic level, this is important because we start breaking off into operational and tactical. So the operational level, you have Pershing and his staff doing operational intelligence. You have Sims, who we talked about before, doing that at the Navy level in England. So you got the operational level. And then the strategic level, which has been my focus, is back in D.C., Van Diemen, who I mentioned, through a lot of cajoling and a lot of gnashing of teeth, actually gets, in the beginning of World War I, gets the MID started up again. And in the ONI, again, it's ballooning with the infusion of money from the government.
Right.
But here's the thing. They're not doing strategic military intelligence that we've talked about. We've talked about with strategic military intelligence, collecting information from other nations and seeing what they're doing. Well, where the money is right now is what I have called domestic security, which is all the stuff that's happening inside the U.S., like counterintelligence, plant security.
Smoking out perceived enemies like anarchists,
right,
and communists.
Right, exactly. It's all that stuff that you hear about with the Red Scare a few years later.
The original Red Scare.
There were actually a couple of episodes of sabotage.
Yeah, some
during the war.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not as many. Well, you know, you hear about it, but it's not as many to justify the amount of resources that were thrown at it. So strategic military intelligence is doing anything but strategic military intelligence. They're doing domestic security inside the United States.
Which is illegal today.
Right, exactly. Right. So, and they were happy to do it because of the fact they were getting money and they were getting a mission. You know, right. I've said this before. They needed to define their mission. They needed to have money. They needed to know what they were doing as a strategic military intelligence organization.
But they're not, for example, conducting studies of the German war economy and feeding that information to Pershing.
Yeah, in fact, a guy named Nolan is his G2. And even in with Sims, who's the effort for the Navy in London, it has his own staff. And they basically are telling Washington, hey, we got this over here. You do whatever you're doing back in Washington. We're getting the intel in Europe.
So it sounds like what you're saying is, according to the modern construct, that the forces in theater are conducting tactical operational theater strategic intel, but there's a break then up to strategic intel.
Right. Now, is this a philosophical split or a practical split in terms of it's not possible? In other words, like today we have all sorts of like satellites, where the national, where the people in Washington D.C. can look and see what's going on and give the warfighter useful information. Is this a case where the guys in D.C. there's no way they're going to get anything useful to give to Pershing anyways? So they just
handle their own business. It's a practical one where like the naval attachés and the army attachés, the information they're getting back to D.C. Is going to be useless by the time they need it anyway. And also they're feeding the same information to the operational centers, and it's a personality split. You know, when you have a big moat like the Atlantic, you're going to have personalities blow up bigger on each side. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that Van Diemen in Washington and Nolan in France didn't get along. It's just the communications took a little bit longer, and you know, even with telegrams, it's hard to get information across.
How does this work with the German U-boat campaign once it resumes in 1917? Because obviously that's a problem for shipping, for port-to-port logistics across the Atlantic. So is there any engagement with this burgeoning strategic intelligence community with that?
Well, there's attempts to. The Office of Naval Intelligence does general reports on the submarine threat. But people like Sims in the Naval department there in London, basically was complaining the whole time that we don't have a good handle of where the naval assets were, like the submarines. And he complains about that after the war, too.
So there's no attempt, or is there an attempt to do any sort of direction finding, electronic intelligence, picking up submarine radio transmissions? Is there any of that electronic warfare going on?
Maybe at the tactical level, but I haven't done much research on that, but I would say at the tactical level, yes. But not at the bigger level.
So there's no big map in Washington, D.C. where they're sitting there going, oh, we got reports of subs here
not really. Yeah.
All right, so World War One sounds like it's still kind of a mess. We move into the interwar years. So what lessons are brought forward from the war into this period, if any?
Well, you have to infuse a few concepts in here. You have demobilization. You have disillusionment. Mm-hmm. You have all these different things that are fusing in that basically are saying World War One is a war that ends all wars. We need to get into peacetime, and
a string of presidents who don't want to spend money on the military.
Right, exactly. And so you get all of a sudden the ONI and MID, who are these strategic military intelligence organizations, are finding, we don't have the money anymore. What are we going to do? We don't even have the people anymore because we demobilize like we ever always do after wars. And so they are struggling again to find out what their mission is, what they're going to do, how they're going to survive. It goes from like 300 personnel at ONI headquarters to back to 20, 30, 40 people trying to figure out what they're going to do.
So what happens here, because this is also the very beginnings of electronic intercept. We're now with HF radios, we're now able to add shortwave. You're able to now pick up and intercept other nations' traffic. But that's the technical thing that's going to require some money to manage.
Yeah.
How do they handle that?
Well, I know that, like with the Army, they had a guy named Yardley who did like a lot of that. And so they have different departments or branches within those organizations are doing that. But again, it's also, there's organizations, operational and tactical, that are forming at the lower levels that are bringing that information up.
So it's the lower levels, which kind of have their own kind of built-in organizations that are handling it, not the national.
Right, exactly. And that will change over time, but yeah.
Well, let's talk about that, because we have this period, as I mentioned, Wilson, Democrat, is an interventionist. He sees himself as kind of a European-style world leader. Mm-hmm. He's followed by Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover, who want nothing to do with any of that.
Return to normalcy.
Right, exactly. That's the famous Harding quote.
Right.
Invented a word. So then we're moving past this period into the 1930s. The Depression happens. It's clear that extremist ideologies are on the rise, you know, the fascists, the Nazis in Japan. So how does this change as we move towards World War II?
Yeah, I focus a lot about the organization size and what they're doing. And I found that, you know, they obviously know they're a skeleton crew. They don't have many people, but they're developing war plans for not only other countries, like war plan black, orange, green, white.
So real quick, just explain what war plan orange is so we have an idea what
okay,
what
yeah,
is.
Orange is Japan, the war plan to go after Japan, and that started, you know, way back in the 1908, I think. And then you have black, which is for Germany. You have white, which is for America. You have green, Mexico. So you have all these different colors or color plans.
Famously, red is for the fighting the British.
Yeah,
right.
So you have all the exactly. So you have all these plans are done both the Army and Navy during this period. But I think the more important thing is they're trying to create war plans for mobilization again. They realize that They have nobody, but they're creating these plans for when we go into the next war, because we always have a next war. What are we going? How are we going to mobilize? So they create these huge organizations that have nobody matched against each of these bullets for the future. Mm-hmm. At the same time, what they're doing to survive is they're doing. They're using their attachés for foreign intelligence. They're doing all that, and there's still that affinity on both organizations to do domestic security again, because I know that money can be that come that way. But the Red Scare and the counter-reaction to what the intrusion into Americans' rights and stuff is basically the Department of the Navy and Department of War basically telling these organizations, you got to knock it off, at least above board, because we're looking bad here, that mm-hmm. you are intruding on our citizens' rights, and we, you're not going to get money that way. Mm-hmm. So they're still trying to figure out what they're going to do until we get into the 1930s, and then we're finding that, as you said, extremism is ramping up. You get a president like FDR who's more amenable to naval and military intelligence. Again, another Roosevelt who is assistant Secretary of the Navy.
Right.
So he knows what intelligence can do. And he is more favorable in 1932 to the increase of money and finances to these organizations.
Let's talk a little bit about the practical side of things. So say they're briefing, if we're in the 1930-1932, I think MacArthur is still the chief of staff of the Army. I think he might be on his way out by about that point. Mm-hmm. But we're sitting there and like, okay, so you're the intel guy. What is it that you're going to do for me during peacetime?
Yeah, and that is the big question. Eisenhower once said in his book, I think Crusade in Europe, that I don't like intel because there's some impressions that you get. One is like the naval attaché or the army attaché is just courting people at parties and not doing real intelligence. And he says anything that smacks of spying is bad. So there's that perception out there in the 1930s. Real or imaginative, that Navy and Army intelligence are spying, and they're not really producing anything that we need to produce.
Okay, are they producing anything?
They are. They're getting all these reports from the naval attachés, Army attachés, that are giving the ground picture of what's going on in Germany, what's going on in South America, Japan. Mm-hmm. Japan's a little bit of a tougher nut to crack because of the closed nature of Japanese society and what they're willing to do.
Right.
But they are getting intel, open source or whatever. That mm-hmm. and it's. But the question is, as always during this whole period, what information are they giving their commanders, and what? And what's the perception of these intel organizations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've talked in a prior podcast about how the Army in particular is building these kind of skeleton units that they know will be scaled in the event of conflict, which becomes more and more certain as we move into the late 30s. Yeah. You could make an argument the war starts in Asia in 1937 and Europe in 1939.
So very briefly, though, go back to our very beginning. You said intelligence is the analysis, mm-hmm. right? So how good is their analysis of these reports? Are they calling it, or are they getting it mostly right?
Here's a problem, and this is what I was going to lead into, is that they should be the experts because they see all these reports all the time. There's a growing movement in the 1930s that culminates in 1940, 1941, that intelligence shouldn't be doing the analysis, that the information should be given to the war plans departments of both organizations, and to the commanders, and they'll make the analysis of the information. And that's the growing movement. There's a guy by the name of Richmond K. Turner for the War Plans Division in 1940 who basically tells the ONI, no, you're not doing analysis. Give me the information, and we'll tell you what it means.
Interesting. So we could probably do an entire episode on World War II, because we could do an entire episode on lots of things in World War II. Could you give us kind of a brief rundown of how strategic intelligence worked in the war?
I would say again that they did better off than World War II or World War I. Strategic intelligence was they give more information to both departments. The problem was is FDR was looking, starting to look elsewhere. There's an organization by the name of OSS, Office of Strategic Services, with General Bill Donovan, Wild Bill. And they're starting to discover that this organization, which does covert action, covert intelligence, to get information from Europe and from Pacific, they're starting to do it better. And the problem with like MID is they kept undergoing reorganization, and that was a chronic problem for two decades, especially big in World War II, where they kept trying to decide how they were going to organize themselves. And so if they're trying to figure out how they're organize themselves, how are they going to get strategic intelligence out there? The Navy does a little bit of the same thing. And what they're finding is they're being shut out again from strategic intelligence from operational intelligence. That's where they could probably make some money, but then they got organizations in Europe again that are doing this type of information. And so they're starting to, again, figure out what their mission is.
So let's talk about two of kind of the most prominent intelligence failures in World War II, Pearl Harbor and the Battle of the Bulge in late 1944. How does something like that happen?
Well, I've done some research, especially on Pearl Harbor, not exactly Battle of the Bulge at the strategic level.
As a Navy guy, we understand.
Yeah. You know, because everybody goes, okay, what did ONI do, especially MID? What did they do? How come they couldn't predict us? Roberta Wolfstetter had an argument that there's a lot of noise out there, and figuring out what the signals are really tough to do, and I get it. Problem with ONI is they were not set up to do strategic warning. Strategic warning is something that we're very familiar today with the intelligence community, where we have all these watch indicators, we have watch floors, people look at the problem of whatever problem set it is, and they look for warning signals that something's going to happen. We didn't have anything remotely similar to that in the late 1930s, early 1940s. All we had was a branch in ONI headed by McCollum, who was looking at all this message traffic, classified or not, and trying to figure out what the Japanese were doing. So you had a few analysts who were trying to figure out what's going on. But again, this is a foreign concept to them in the late 1940s, early 1940s, late 1930s, is how do we warn that something's going to happen?
So, quick question. So, MAGIC, the black hole out in Pearl Harbor, where they're doing all the code breaking, you know, the famous Wake Island. Is this ONI? Is this a branch of ONI? Or is this the Pacific Fleet?
This is Pacific Fleet. So, when you're talking about, you have a guy named Edward Layton who's helping Nimitz out during World War II. It's operational intelligence done in an operational theater. Back at ONI, you have these analysts getting this message traffic, but they're not many. There's only like two or three in the whole, organization. So they're better suited out in the Pacific to do that type of stuff.
So it sounds like we've gone back to the World War I style of tactical, operational, theater, strategic in the theater.
Yeah.
And strategic divorced from that.
Right, right.
Interesting.
And well, the problem is, by the end of World War II, ONI is actually getting into the operational realm. There's a guy by the name of Ellis Zacharias, kind of a loose cannon. He was the assistant commander for ONI, and tried to take the commander's job and got fired. But he had some good concepts about operational intelligence that ONI took on board by the end of World War II. And they were actually starting to do pretty well. And they were helping the fleet intelligence, and they were starting to get better by 1944, 1945, mainly because they were starting to realize that organizations like OSS were starting to squeeze them out of strategic intelligence. Mm-hmm. So we get to after the war, and ONI and MID again are wondering, what do we do again? What's our mission? And then we get to 1947 and the National Security Act, and the CIA and NSA, which are formed, basically subsume ONI and MID down into the lower operational strategic level, operational level.
Mm-hmm. So this is a fascinating topic. We could spend hours talking about all the different elements of the things we've covered. But unfortunately, we're out of time for this episode. What would you say students at CGSC should take away from this kind of evolution of military intelligence during this period?
That intelligence is not static. Whether you talk about what the missions are, how big intelligence organizations are, what is expected from commanders. The commanders expect different things from intelligence, whether it's the type of intelligence they are getting, the type of analysis they are getting. This is not a static topic, and it changes over time, and that you got to be flexible. If you're an intelligence officer, you got to be flexible about what your commanders want. If you're a consumer of intelligence, you got to know what that intelligence organization can provide you.
Mm-hmm. No, very good. Dr. Mosman, it's been fascinating. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it being on.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.